Welcome to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host, Ankit Panda, and joining me today are the rest of the associate editors here at the Diplomat, Shannon Tiazzi, Prashant Parameswaran, and Franz Stefan Gatti. Thanks a lot for joining me, guys. I'm really looking forward to this as usual. We will devote this podcast exclusively to China. It's a big week in China. It's the National People's Congress. That's when China's parliament gathers to discuss the Communist Party's agenda, including, you know, setting important things like growth targets, passing budgets, passing all sorts of important laws. And we'll get to some of the details. Just as a preview for listeners, we'll be talking about, for sure, the defense budget of China, which is a topic that I know a lot of diplomat listeners will be interested in. We'll be talking about China's new draft anti-terror law, which has important implications for U.S.-China relations. Also, in the context of the defense budget, I also want to kind of talk about recent comments by U.S. analysts, including the Director of National Intelligence, about China's reclamation activities in the South China Sea. And also, we'll talk a bit about China's economic outlook and new growth target of 7%. Notably, the defense budget will grow by 10.1%, and the defense budget is shrinking down to a 7% target, which means that we're starting to see a greater decoupling between China's defense budget targets and its growth targets, which hasn't historically been the case. At least over the past 10 years, the defense budget and the growth target have been about the same, suggesting that, you know, China isn't militarizing at a rate that outpaces its GDP growth. But now that looks to be changing. Anyways, to start things off, Shannon, since you're our resident China expert, do you just kind of give us a very brief walkthrough of the National People's Congress, what we can expect out of this year's session, and the similarities and differences from previous years, I guess?
Great, sure. So this year's National People's Congress actually just officially started on Thursday. Before that, we were seeing meetings from the CPPCC, which is the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, which is the other of the two sessions that they call, that takes place in March. So all this week, we've been seeing interviews and announcements from the CPPCC, the NPC, and the National People's Congress officially open on Thursday. So we're very early in this process, but still a lot of the major announcements have been made. We saw Premier Li Keqiang giving his government work report on Thursday, which contains a lot of the actual facts and figures for China. As you mentioned, they have set their target for economic growth at around 7% for 2015. Just like last year, they are considering this a soft target. One analyst said even 6.8% growth would still be considered acceptable from Beijing's point of view. That would give them the lowest amount of growth since 1990 if they did fall in at around that 7% range as expected. They also, as you mentioned, set up their budget. The military budget has been getting the most amount of attention with its 10.1% increase. But they also had some other interesting facts in there. They're going to continue pushing infrastructure development despite this push for China's new economic reforms that are supposed to move away from reliance on infrastructure. And they're also setting a budget deficit that's a little bit higher than previous years, which is also interesting.
Okay, great. We'll come back to the issue of economic growth. But first, I just kind of want to talk about the defense budget. Franz and Prashant, I mean, obviously, you know, I kind of want to hear from you guys on this one. Franz, so you, you know, covered the defense budget increase for us. China's defense budget is going up 10.1% to $141 billion per year. Obviously, you know, I've read some analysis. I mean, this happens every year that these statistics might not be entirely accurate. The numbers might actually be higher. Also, importantly, we don't actually have a breakdown of a service-by-service expenditures. We don't know where most of this money is going, but we do have a good idea if it's going to the PLA Navy, the PLA Air Force, or the infantry. So, Franz, what's your take on this latest Chinese budget announcement? Are you concerned as an analyst, you know, regarding China's militarization in the Asia Pacific, or is this, you know, pretty much what we expected?
Well, I would say it's pretty much expected. Let me first say that the Chinese defense budget does not take into account various expenditures such as weapons import, research and development, and money spent on the PLA strategic forces, for example. Real military expenditure may be as much as 40 to 55% higher Overall, I think we'll see more investment in the PLA Navy, the Chinese Navy, and for very obvious reason, of course. Also, generally, the Chinese military is pushing for modernization and, more importantly, informatization of the armed forces, because I do think they have a very poor track record of the latter. And also, we should not forget that the PLA actually is still in the process of mechanization of its armed forces. So I think if you want to compare the United States military with the Chinese military, the Chinese People's Liberation Army still has a long way to go, particularly the Navy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just on that note, I think there's been a lot of attention to a recent report that suggests that China has more submarines just in raw numbers and tonnage compared to the U.S. Yeah. Navy. But obviously that's completely, you know, not an appropriate way to compare capabilities. I mean, yeah, what's your thought on that?
I would probably say most analysis, or a lot, at least, you know, most newspapers out there focus primarily on the capabilities of the military, and I think they forget to take into account tactical capabilities, operational capabilities, strategic capabilities, and when it comes to the Navy, as undersea warfare capabilities are very important, but we should not forget logistics, you know, air cover, air warfare capabilities, air strike capabilities, sea strike capabilities. And above, I think that's really, really, really PLA is still at a major disadvantage vis-a-vis Japan and the United States experience. The last point I wanted to make is that ultimately, when it comes to analyzing or comparing military strength, it's always a relative analysis. That is, you know, we can't just, you know, focus on one force. We always have to compare it to the likely opponent that it will be facing. I mean, that's, I think, a very pretty obvious point. But ultimately, the arbiter over quality of training and the quality of a force is actual conflict. And we haven't seen proper sea naval warfare in a couple of decades.
Right, right. I mean, obviously, like all of what you said, I agree with about the PLA's tactical and operational readiness. We've known for a long time that, you know, they aren't on the same level nearly as, I mean, not only the U.S. Navy, but also I'd say the Japanese Navy and a few other regional navies maybe. But, you know, there are also some interesting capability gaps that I'd be interested to see if the PLA is going to address. Anti-submarine warfare is a big one, particularly with submarine proliferation in Southeast Asia. Maybe for Sean, you can maybe speak to this a bit, and we can talk about this in the context of the South China Sea reclamation issue. That's always been an area where the Chinese military has sort of had a weakness, and I think, you know, we're seeing countries like Vietnam and other navies in the region trying to exploit that by acquiring their own submarines. Prashant, you know, what's your what is your take on the recent, you know, comments by among other people, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, about China's South China Sea reclamation projects? As a diplomat, listeners might be aware, China is is undertaking construction activities, building artificial islands, essentially unsinkable aircraft carriers in the Spratly Island chain and elsewhere in the South China Sea. That's caused some concern among observers. Prashant, what do you make of, those activities and the reaction to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think let me first just say broadly, I mean, I definitely agree with both France and yourself regarding the, you know, the cautiousness in terms of estimating and evaluating China's military capabilities. I think definitely in terms of readiness, but also if you look at some of the institutional and combat shortcomings, if you look at the areas like professionalism, you look at corruption, there was a recent report that came out with the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, and I think, France, you did an article on this, actually, which looked at, you know, any range of problems from morale, discipline, corruption, outdated command structures. So there's a whole variety of things that, you know, China is lacking if you look at some of these other things beyond the weapons that we often talk about and some of the capabilities. So I think that's definitely a really important point to keep in mind. On Clapper's remarks, I think it was a really interesting hearing. I mean, it's in terms of how they communicated about China's land reclamation activities. John McCain actually, during the House Armed Services Committee hearing, actually displayed the satellite imagery that, you know, sort of displayed how extensive China's land reclamation efforts are. And I think that's what distinguishes it from other countries. I mean, other claimants in the South China Sea, including Malaysia and so forth, have engaged in these kinds of activities before. But, you know, A, their capabilities are a lot less than China. B, they haven't really attempted to change the features in the South China Sea as much as the Chinese have. To the extent of even creating entirely new features through extensive dredging efforts and the like. And then thirdly, I mean, if you pair that up with China's legal claims, which are massive, I think James Clapper put it, I think he said exorbitant, I think was the word that he used. If you pair it up with that, it's extremely concerning. And I think there's a little bit of a sort of... I wouldn't say a debate, but there's a little bit of a conversation about how to view this, whether the Chinese are actively trying to, they're looking at this as a more military effort to sort of, you know, build these features and then create other capabilities that can threaten other countries, or whether the Chinese are just trying to change the reality on the ground to enforce legal claims that they've already made. So the Chinese have basically said, well, if we don't have a nine-dash line, we're going to basically create the conditions to be able to enforce the nine-dash line. And so that's concerning whether you look at it from either the military dimension or the legal dimension.
Right. Let me just play the optimist for a second. And, you know, I mean, we've obviously seen China kind of use its military for some of those, I guess, you'd call it responsible stakeholder behavior on the in the international community. You know, things like assisting in the international fight against Ebola, using PLA resources for that, assisting in anti-piracy efforts, assisting in international peacekeeping efforts. Shannon, I guess this is probably a question for you. You know, do you think that we're going to see more of that from China over this next year or in the short term? Is that a priority of Xi Jinping and the current leadership? Or, you know, is the military defense budget increase primarily directed towards these other more, I guess, nefarious endeavors in the South China Sea and elsewhere?
Well, I wouldn't call these sort of humanitarian efforts a priority for China. I think, as Franz mentioned, there's a lot of other things China wants to do with its defense budget, including boosting the informatization of their army, continuing the modernization process. But at the same time, there is an increasing interest in these humanitarian missions. I think China had to be nudged a little bit to get involved in the Ebola crisis. But ever since it has gotten involved, and as you mentioned, that was largely through the deployment of PLA medical units and also PLA teams that were constructing facilities, they've sort of realized the benefits that come with that. There's been a lot of coverage in the Chinese media of how grateful the African governments are for the help. This has been... since the time of Hu Jintao, humanitarian and disaster relief missions for the PLA have been considered one of the new historic missions that the army should be taking on. And we haven't really seen that much of it. And I think now that the capabilities are increasing, we're starting to see that as well. And there is a flip side to it, too, where it gets China practice with deploying its troops to these far-flung regions. Even if they're there for completely humanitarian purposes, it does help bolster their military readiness.
Right. Absolutely. All right. Well, I kind of want to move the conversation down to get to some of the other issues that we want to talk about. Obviously, the Chinese military is something we'll come back to regularly on this podcast. The next thing, I guess, that I kind of want to go to is just the general economic situation in China. Obviously, this new growth target of 7% or 6.8%. Shannon, I was also wondering, you know, back during, you know, the third plenum and stuff, there was a lot of talk about reform to state-owned enterprises as sort of increasing the competitiveness of the Chinese economy in several important sectors. I think there's an interesting angle there with the anti-corruption movement as well, as a lot of state-owned enterprises are being investigated. Can we expect any sort of significant reform on the SOEs, or is, you know, the time not right yet for Xi Jinping and the leadership to really take on this issue? Because it seems to me like they're starting to kind of use this anti-corruption movement to address some of the issues of like entrenched interests in the state-owned enterprises system. But, you know, there are some troubling signs. I think there's signs that China will be consolidating state-owned enterprises into larger enterprises, reducing the competitiveness of the economy. And additionally, I think there's proposals to allow for minority private capital stakes in state-owned enterprises, which probably isn't the best way to go about building a more competitive economy. I don't know. What can we expect on SOEs this year?
That's going to be a very interesting question. Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang have chosen this year, 2015, as a crucial year for starting to push forward on some of these reforms, which were actually announced at the very end of 2012 when Xi and Li came to power. So now we're, you know, moving into 3 years since these reforms have been initiated. People are really going to start saying, well, what have you done? What progress have you made? And in terms of SOE reform, there hasn't really been a lot. And part of that is because these represent very powerful interest groups within China's political system. Mm-hmm. So in part, you have to remove the groups that are going to oppose you. And that's getting done through the anti-corruption reform, whether you're actually ousting these powerful groups, for example, Zhou Yongkang's petroleum clique, as the Chinese media is calling it, where he had allies throughout the petroleum industry that have now been ousted by the anti-corruption movement, or whether it's just in Chinese, as they say, killing the chicken to scare the monkeys, you know, taking out some people and then everyone else is too afraid to oppose you. The question is whether that's going to be effective enough to allow Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang to push through the sort of reforms that they want. And that's supposed to be under discussion at this year's MPC. You know, how are they going to reform SOEs? We're just going to have to wait and see what they actually come up with, whether that looks meaningful and what it actually is going to mean.
Yeah, it's a very difficult issue. I mean, I don't think I'm based on what I've read, I don't think I'm optimistic for a very, you know, abrupt change to the SOE system. I think it's one of those features of the Chinese economy that will require a gradual process of change. And that definitely seems like what the leadership is going for as well. But it's interesting how the anti-corruption movement has also kind of been used to address this sort of economic reform issue. That'll be something I'll be really looking to see after this year's MPC. What's your, you know, let's also go back to this new normal growth rate of 7%. I mean, obviously, it's kind of good to see the Chinese economy acknowledging to international investors that, you know, it is heading towards a more sustainable and slower rate of growth. And, you know, China is obviously okay with that. And I think it's pretty bold to accept a number like 6.8%. I just feel like, you know, just having that number 6 there is just psychologically very different to investors than seeing something like 7, which I think, you know, puts China in the fast-growing large economies bucket of economies. Obviously, you know, you have like projections for India at possibly something like 8% and Brazil and South Africa, and, well, not Russia, but, you know, so how do you think that's going to affect how international investors are approaching China this year? And I guess this is a question for anybody that really wants to chime in here.
Well, I think the Chinese government is very, very sensitive to this. They are sick of reading these media reports from the West saying China's economy is crashing, it's in for a hard landing. So when they announced this, they very much stressed that this is the new normal. This is an intentional decision to slow growth, as opposed to creating the impression that China's growth is just plummeting. And also, interestingly, they sort of drew a line in the sand and they said, okay, we're slowing down to 7% growth. We're going to try to keep 7% growth for the foreseeable future. One scholar even said next 20 years, China can grow 7% every year. Which is a pretty incredible statement to make at the same time that you're trying to back your country away from such an emphasis on growth rather than the nature of growth and is the growth sustainable. So they're trying very hard to say, yes, we've slowed down to 7%. that is intentional, and we're not going to slow down anymore. I think from a foreign investor standpoint, rather than just China's slowing growth, there are a lot of other concerns, including market access. You had a lot of events in the past year that have started to cause foreign firms to question how friendly Beijing is towards foreign investment. You had the anti-monopoly crackdown, which a lot of people saw as a failed way of going after foreign firms. You have this new anti-terrorism law that you mentioned earlier that's going to put really onerous restrictions on foreign technological firms. You also have a greater push to remove these technological firms from China at all, and replace them with Chinese domestic competition. So, you know, slowing growth may be a concern, but I think the bigger concern is how much does China really want foreign investment?
Right. And I think that's a good segue into the discussion about the draft anti-terror law, which I think is, I've seen some coverage of it, but I don't think the true significance of this law is really being kind of dissipated by the media so far. I mean, I know a lot of the U.S. economic media has picked up on it, but I think this is a really significant milestone if China does go ahead with this law, since, you know, one of the features of this law is obviously that it addresses both cybersecurity and anti-terrorism, both issues that are just really sensitive points for the Chinese government. And I feel like if it comes to negotiations with the United States, there's going to be very little budge room for the Chinese on this. And that obviously leads to the troubling consequence that Western firms will be asked to comply with these new onerous restrictions on conducting their business in China or asked to leave. Now, just to update listeners, these restrictions include including backdoors to give the Chinese government access into secure communications, hosting all data on the Chinese mainland related to Chinese citizens, and I also think to just customers in general. And additionally, I think things like private VPNs, which have been a big feature for private firms operating in China, will be banned under this new law. So obviously, compliance with this law will just entirely change the name of the game for companies like, Microsoft, IBM, Facebook, anybody doing, all sorts of other Western technological firms. Cybersecurity-wise, I mean, the U.S. response has been really interesting. I mean, we saw four cabinet members, right, the Chinese government already, the Secretary of State, the Treasury Secretary, the Commerce Secretary, and the U.S. Trade Representative. That's obviously a really significant number of cabinet members riding the Chinese government. And I think we've seen the Obama administration actually in its diplomacy with the Chinese show that it's interested in showing U.S. tech firms that it will stand up for intellectual property, it will stand up for their right to do business in China. And I think the best example of this was probably last year's indictment of the five PLA officials. You know, one of the explanations of why the United States would go ahead and do that was that they wanted to send a signal to Silicon Valley, let them know that, China can't just get away without imposing any costs. Franz, I wanted to ask you about this too, because, you know, you obviously think a lot about cybersecurity issues. What do you think the longer term impact of this anti-terror law will be if it does end up getting passed? I guess not just on U.S.-China commerce, but in terms of broader cybersecurity relations between the two sides?
Well, I think it's obviously a very opportunistic move, and it's also based partially based on the United States sort of losing the moral advantage in cyberspace due to the Snowden revelations. We've seen similar trends all over the world, Brazil, Europe, and I do think that bluntly say it, it's obviously a form of protectionism and a very, very straightforward way for Chinese companies to gain more market share and become less dependent on outside technology. I think that the United States' response was fairly predictable, and I think I could even tie this whole thing into the overall efforts of the United States to deter China from overstepping its activities in cyberspace, because I think the United States' strong reaction to this new law is obviously a sign that the U.S. Washington has not figured out really how to properly deal with the threat coming from China, how to deal with Chinese cyber espionage. I do want to say that, and I think that's very true for the past couple of years that the real danger coming in cyberspace are actually Russian hackers, not so much Chinese hackers. The reason why we talk so much about Chinese intrusions is it's the quantity, not so much the quality, and also because they don't really care about leaving behind any traces in cyberspace, so it's easier to attribute Chinese attacks than Russian attacks. I do one last point that I would like to make is that for the past year and a half, the United States time and again has tried to diffuse tensions in cyberspace, and the Chinese have just not reacted. They usually give their stock phrase response whenever the United States throws an accusation against them. That is that China is the biggest victim of cybercrime, which may be true, but they have created this veneer of plausible deniability, and it's very difficult to have a dialogue with the Chinese on this subject. But the United States has taken very concrete steps, such as giving a briefing to senior PLA officials on the United States cyber war doctrine a couple of months back. They have also revealed zero-day vulnerabilities to the wider world, which is sort of like a unilateral disarmament in cyberspace, and a number of other things. So I do think the strong reaction that we see now is sort of like a default, a fallback option, just because the United States has not really figured out how to properly deal with these Chinese cyber attacks.
Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, diplomatically, I guess, Shannon, Franz, Prashant, do you think that the United States will be able to approach China about this in any way? I mean, it just seems like this is just an incredibly sensitive topic, given that it's at the intersection of cyber and terrorism issues. And it just seems like the diplomatic response is going to be very difficult, especially with all these topics of hypocrisy and stuff.
Well, one thing that we forget often is the military component to all of this. And I think Chinese military doctrine, although they're, obviously we don't know the official doctrine, cyberspace plays a huge role in trying to offset the conventional advantages of the United States or its allies vis-a-vis the People's Liberation Army, and the Chinese military is heavily investing in cyber capabilities, and they're still probably 10 years behind. So I think one of the reluctance just stems from the fact that most of their military outlook is based on improving its cyber weaponry.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, they obviously don't want to, discuss it too much.
Yeah, I think also, I mean, it's this anti-terror law that we're discussing. It also, beyond the cyber component, it also has, other significant components that makes it difficult to sort of address holistically. So, I mean, there's I think, Ankit, you mentioned this in your piece. I mean, there's also a very strong human rights dimension to this, which is how broadly the Chinese are defining terrorism. And part of this is very domestically oriented as well, in terms of their ongoing crackdown in Xinjiang. And human rights advocates are very worried about, what this means in terms of a broad definition and how that might lead to the arrest of activists. Beyond the military dimension that we discussed earlier, there was also as you discussed, a private sector component as well. So the U.S. government has reacted, but it's also partly because U.S. companies are extremely concerned about what this means for them operating in China. And then there's also another element, which is the U.S. domestic debate that France was mentioning, because, after the Snowden incident, there's been efforts by U.S. firms, too, to, encrypt their data more heavily and, make their products and services more secure against U.S. government intrusion. And the U.S. government has said, we're not very happy about this. So you're seeing it play out on so many different dimensions. So,
yeah. I think diplomatically this is very difficult because these are legitimate concerns that China has, these cybersecurity concerns. And the U.S. knows that because it set a precedent of denying access to a Chinese technological firm, Huawei, on the basis of concerns that the Chinese government could use Huawei to spy on U.S. facilities. And now the Chinese government is basically turning that around and saying, look, from these revelations from Snowden and the NSA leak, we already know that the NSA is using backdoor access to U.S. and the Japanese and other firms. and we use those firms here in China. And that's a security concern for us. And so we're going to try to push them out. And it's very tough for the U.S. firms, and it's a terrible situation for them. But diplomatically, it's hard for the U.S. to take issue with that central claim that reliance on foreign technology is a security risk.
Right. Yeah. And that's, I think, like the central issue when it comes to these claims of hypocrisy. You know, China has every right to indigenize its technology to ensure, you know, its own security. So I think it'll be a very difficult line of negotiation for the U.S. to follow here with China. Anyways, thanks a lot, guys, for joining me on the podcast. As always, the discussion was illuminating. And obviously, the National People's Congress continues for, I think, about, what, 8 or 9 more days, Shannon?
Yeah, 10 days total. So.
Okay, yeah. And we'll have more coverage of that on our website, so definitely keep an eye out there. Thanks a lot for joining me.
Thanks for having us.